back to the bin.
Here we go. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I have the long-awaited return of Mr. Ryan Daly to the show. He and I have been talking, I don't know, 2 years, however long it's been, 3 years, whatever crazy amount. And I've been on the Cheers cast a few times, so we can cross-promote that. And we are actually, in an effort to cross-promote it, we are using today to do a double header. We are recording an episode of Bins, and we are recording an episode of the Cheers cast. So anybody who listens to the show and actually likes hearing me, which I'm not sure why, if you don't already listen to Cheers cast, please sign on to that. It's a lot of fun. And quite frankly, just to, you know, go on that subject a little, it's a lot more difficult, I think, to do an index show on a sitcom than it is on a dramatic show, because you don't have the, you know, the dramatic storylines that are going on to hit on, and themes like that, although there are all themes on the show. It's a little different, and I think it's a little more difficult, and I'm going to say I think you do a great job with it, Ryan.
Well, I appreciate that. There is a great deal of repetitiveness to it, but that also helps in some ways simplify the process. It kind of gives me a basic format to follow, and I don't have to deviate a whole lot. Because the episodes are shorter, that also kind of just it typically goes a little bit more briskly. to the point that you made earlier, yeah, you have been on Cheers since the beginning, sometimes multiple episodes a season. It was probably like the second or third appearance or something that we were talking about. I would do an episode of Bins for you. It's got to be like 7 years.
No, you have been on Bins a couple of times, and there was once you use markers in your life as timeline things, and I've been in this house that I live in now for four and a half years now, and I do have a recollection of recording a Bins episode with you while I was here. So it's been somewhere in that time gap, but I think it's been about 2 years since we've been doing this episode, and you picked your issue and gave it to me and said, this is the one when I come on, I'm going to cover. And it was so long ago that when we talked about recording today, you had to say to me, now, which issue am I covering?
Yeah, which one did I pick?
So, and along those lines, I have this tendency, despite the show being by nature a random look at comics, mm-hmm. when I have a guest on and they pick a book, if there's something I think complements it, I try to go with that. So what jumped out at me on this issue is that you picked an issue of Spider-Woman, and we'll get to that in a mm-hmm. moment. And it is the art in it is by Steve Lealoha. I gotta say mm-hmm. that correctly. Now we'll talk more about his artwork as this goes on, but I was under the misconception, or the slight misconception, and we'll talk about that more, that his artwork was very, very similar to, I'm having my senior moment, that his artwork was very, very similar to Carmine Infantino's, and there's moments where it is, and again, we'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. I've made it known, I'm not particularly an Infantino fan. People who love the Star Wars stuff he did, people who love his stuff on Flash, kind of take issue with my lack of Carmine Infantino love. But I decided, you know what, you picked this issue, in my mind, he's similar to Carmine. And I think that was because Carmine drew earlier issues of Spider-Man.
Right,
that,
right.
Again, I'm another point. So what I did in an effort to be consistent is I picked an issue that he drew also, and we're going to get to that next. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, we could have some serious talk about the artwork as we go along. Mm-hmm. But in the meanwhile, do you have any recollection, it's been so long, as to why you picked this issue?
So over on one of the other podcasts that I do, FW Team Up on the Fire and Water Podcast Network, which is hosted by Siskoid, he has every episode, every month he has, it's broken up. The episode FW Team Up covers four different shows. with Siskoid hosting each one and a different guest or different co-host for each one. So there's a series that covers the Batman, the Brave and the Bold issues, or just the Brave and the Bold with Batman team-ups, DC Comics Presents with Superman team-ups, Marvel 2-in-1, which is mine, which is the thing, and then Marvel team-up with Spider-Man. So I am the co-host on the Marvel 2-in-1 issues, and for about, because it only comes out three times a year, because we're every 4 months, we've been covering the Spider, the thing goes to the UK, the thing goes to England kind of story arc, and that goes across 5 or 6 issues. And it includes the early appearances, not the first appearance, but the earlier appearances of Jessica Drew as Spider-Woman. And it kind of sets up, kind of recalibrates her origin and kind of moves her from being an agent of Hydra to a superhero. And I liked her story. I liked the character. I love her costume. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. So when I was prepping for the show with Siskoid over that a while ago, a year ago, that's when I started rereading these issues of Spider-Woman, which I had read a bunch of them before. So I had the character on the brain. So that when you were mentioning, like, what issue could I do? I was like, well, I've been reading a couple of Spider-Woman books. Let's grab one of these.
Okay. So, I mean, there is a random nature to it, even though it's not totally random.
I didn't pick one. I was like, oh, I love this issue. I've always wanted to talk about this issue. It was more of like, this one was in front of me at the time.
Well, that's, and again, when I talk about the show being random by nature, even though there's a lot of times where it's like, I want to cover this issue because I love it. You know, the general crux of the show is to hit random comic books. I think it's actually in the podcast description that they're random. Mm-hmm. So we violate that often, but I think it's good that you actually picked one that is, you know, it's not so much, oh, I love this. It's, hey, there's a book on my, you know, on the top of my list. Let's just look at it.
You've also done so many episodes of this series. I wasn't like, what? What issue of the, you know, the classic classic Avengers could I pick that you guys haven't talked about already many times?
Yeah, somewhere Gene Hendricks keeps a running tab on what issues we've covered and which ones we haven't, which becomes very useful when you get into the 700 and something episode range. And it's like, oh, have we ever covered this one before? And there have been some duplicates where we've covered an issue a second time for reasons, you know, often because it's different people talking about it than the first time, or because we're doing a sequence of issues. So, you know, we violate the rules all the time. This one doesn't violate the rules. And do you have a synopsis for us?
I do. Forgive me if this one goes a little bit long. I put a little bit more detail into this than I meant to. But yeah, we are talking about Spider-Woman issue 44. This one is written by Chris Claremont, who can be a little bit wordy, and that might have come up in the plot synopsis. The art and cover, as you mentioned, was by Steve Lealoa. Letters by Tom Orzechowski, edited by Denny O'Neill. It was 22 pages for only 60 cents back at the time. The time being, it was cover dated June 1982. The on sale date was February 23rd, 1982. After the deadly Hydra agent Viper puts Jessica Drew's roommate in intensive care, Jessica, in both her civilian identity as a private detective and her superhero guise as Spider-Woman, works tirelessly through the day and into the night, questioning San Francisco's criminals and cops until she learns Viper's location. Jessica's boyfriend, David Ashima, tries to warn her of the danger, but she's obsessed. She takes David's motorcycle and rides down to Viper's secret compound in Big Sur. Before Spider-Woman can infiltrate it, she receives a cryptic message and warning from her nemesis, Morgan Le Fay. Then, with that amounting to nothing other than a page filler, Spider-Woman sneaks into Viper's base, except it turns out to be a trap. Viper sends hordes of Hydra goons against her. Jessica beats the green-clad grunts pretty handily, despite the fact that for every one of them she dispenses with, more seem to take its place. Weird how that works. Viper flees to the dock, but Spider-Woman is hot on her heels and destroys the escape boat. The women trade shots at each other, though Viper is strangely complimentary of and concerned for the superhero. Viper even considers the killing of Spider-Woman a gift to spare Jessica from a worse fate, some vague coming catastrophe. Spider-Woman tackles Viper into the ocean, but stops herself from killing her enemy. In return for her life, Viper blasts her with some kind of dark energy that thrusts Spider-Woman into the trippy, mystical dimension of C'thon. I imagine maybe C'thon? I don't know. The dread demon wants to take possession of Jessica's soul, just as he took Viper years before, but Spider-Woman resists and tries to escape from the evil domain. Before all hope is lost, Viper arrives and saves Spider-Woman, being inspired by the younger woman's resistance and taking advantage to overthrow her master. Jessica and Viper return to our dimension, just offshore of Viper's house where they fought. Viper says her real name was Miriam Drew, and she's probably Jessica's mother. Then she teleports away, leaving Jessica to swim back to the beach. Also, Jessica is naked for some reason.
I thought this one was a handful to get through, honestly, because I wasn't familiar with what was going on in the story. But I thought Claremont's wordiness actually worked to their benefit in this issue, or to my benefit, because it reminded me, I have a lot of these Spider-Woman issues, but I haven't read a lot of them, honestly. And part of that goes to what we were just talking about, that I'm just not a Carmine Infantino fan. And when he was drawing the strip, or the book rather, it kind of turned me off to it. And it was at a time where I had a pull list and issues would get pulled for me, but those would go on the bottom of the to read stack because I didn't care for the art. And then, you know, a lot of them I never got to. And then, you know, again, I kind of likened this to Infantino, even though that was not necessarily an accurate read on my part. So I hadn't read any of this. That's my very wordy way of saying that. But I found it to be an experience similar to when I started collecting comics and I was trying to get a feel for issues, you know, different series. You know, you pick up a story and it's in the middle of a three-issue arc. Right. And, you know, you have the footnotes, which this really doesn't have, but you have the footnotes that call back to what went on, and you have, you know, the characters expositing on things. That this has. between the exposition in the dialogue and the exposition in the, you know, the editor's notes as we go along, it kind of gives you a good feel for the storyline and you don't feel so lost. So I liked that aspect of it.
Yeah.
Storyline seemed to change as it went. You know, initially it feels like a detective story and then it feels like a universal monster story. So but it does so in a what feels to be a generic way without forcing it. It just feels like it moves along to that. So I was surprisingly enamored with this story, as it turns out. I expected to dislike it, and I ended up liking it, and I ended up feeling like, and I say this so often, so I have to put the asterisk on this, that it may never happen, but it did give me the feeling of, hey, I'd like to read some more of this and see where it went.
And that's awesome. I think, yeah, as weird as kind of like, you're right, like it's almost like three acts for this one. It starts off as almost a hard-boiled detective story with her grilling the police liaison in the beginning. And then in the middle, it's just a superhero, like could have been an Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. thing with her fighting a whole bunch of Hydra agents. And then this monster thing in the last third, it is a little bit weird. But as you were kind of mentioning, I think the fact that it's a Chris Claremont story, a Chris Claremont script, will give it a higher floor, you know. The ceiling might not be, you know, as high as his great work on X-Men or other things like that. It might not achieve those heights or anywhere near those, but it's going to be fairly good regardless, just because of his competency and his talent as a writer. You know, it's not going to be horrible. And I think this one was really good. In the book, the series itself was kind of weird because, I mean, it lasted 50 issues, and I guess like at the time they kind of considered that a failure, but look how many series get 50 issues today. It's like, unless it doesn't happen. But yeah, it went through a bunch of different creative turnovers, like lots of different writers. Marv Wolfman started the series, and then Mark Gruenwald wrote a few. Michael Fleischer wrote maybe just one. No, Michael Fleischer wrote a couple, and then J.M. DeMatteis wrote, I think, just one. And then Claremont took over the book with issue 34. And I think he leaves after the next issue. But there was also, there were different, like Carmine Infantino was the artist at first, and then Frank Springer took over, and then Trevor Von Eden. So there was just, it was hard for the book to maintain a consistent tone and feel, because it felt like kind of when every new writer came aboard, they brought in their own guest cast and kind of thematic elements that they wanted to play with. And it's just,
that
it's
was a big Claremont thing to bring in his guest casts.
Right, right. You know, so a lot of Japanese and a lot of Japanese people in those issues. I'm like, okay, San Francisco, sure, but like there's this whole subplot with like the policewoman whose name is Morel, but she's French Japanese or something. Might be a Yakuza agent. I don't know.
I would think, and this may be totally stereotyping things on my part, and I apologize if I am. I don't want to do that. But I would just think California in general, the West Coast in general, would have a higher Asian population just because of its proximity geographically to Asia. Right. So I think that lends itself for a story that's taking place in San Francisco. And this is, again, maybe me stereotyping things. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there isn't a large Asian, because I know there is a large Asian population in areas of New York. So that may totally kill my thought. But anyway, like I would think that would lend itself to Claremont's doing this. And while some of the writers you mentioned I hold in fairly high esteem, I'm thinking that once Claremont took over, he kind of just wrapped up whatever they had going on and started his own storylines, which are usually pretty intricate. I do like, you know, if I'm going to go with Claremont, I did like mostly when he was with Byrne, who would, you know, together they'd kind of have the plot lines going and all of that. And I thought it would be, you know, I thought it was more seamless, but I still like Claremont's work very much. I met Claremont at New York Comic Con one time, and he struck me, it was around the time when The Wolverine came out.
Okay.
And he seemed exceptionally bitter about his storylines being used and him not necessarily getting the credit that he had earned. And while, you know, I don't go with going through life being bitter, I kind of don't blame him. You know, it's one of the things I always said, you know, when I know I'm going off target here, but when there's creators who created a comic character and then they go on to make millions of dollars or billions of dollars, and they say, hey, you know, I created this, why aren't I getting anything for it? I do say, you know, hey, you know what? You will work for hire. You signed the contract. Mm-hmm. You signed away the rights. It's, you know, it is what it is. I like when the companies also say, hey, we're going to still throw you a bone just the same. But I kind of go on both sides of the fence with those arguments. So I was sympathetic to his thought process when we were talking about The Wolverine, which I think either just opened or was just about to open. Again, now I'll getting back to this.
Movies.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, like, superhero and like comic book movies, they're a little bit. Are we losing our connection?
I still have you. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yeah, I can hear you. Sorry. I was going to say that superhero and comic book movies are kind of a strange beast, because with a lot of things, if a movie is going to adapt a book, a novel, or something like that, there's generally like a set storyline with set characters, and you know the formula. Even if the movie takes some liberties or some dramatic license, you kind of know what you're going to expect. But superhero and comic book movies may be taking ideas and characters, but they're rarely beholden to a certain particular story. Like even the movie Captain America Civil War was a very different experience than the comic book written by Miller. And I was luckily it was a really good movie. In fact, I liked the movie more than I liked the comic book. But I'm like, if you went expecting just a normal adaptation of that comic, it was kind of like more like we're inspired by the book Civil War more than we are trying to replicate it on screen. So I can see from a comic or a creator standpoint, whether it's an artist or a writer, seeing a movie that maybe has the name of their work on the screen and being like, that's not really what I did or what I had in mind or what I put my heart and soul into that you're translating. So that's assuming the movie is even good, which sometimes they're not. So
I think you have two aspects of that particular discussion. I don't even want to call it an argument. You have a situation like the Claremont situation where several parts of the movie, The Wolverine, were taken from the miniseries, the initial miniseries that he did with Frank Miller. You know, parts of it were adapted from that, although it's certainly not a clean adaptation. And he felt like, well, you know, maybe I should have been more involved. Maybe I should have gotten more credit, whatever the case may be. I don't want to speak for him. But then you also have cases, and this isn't a comic book movie, but I think it's maybe one of the most famous versions, is the Stanley Kubrick's adaptation of The Shining, which Stephen King came right out and said, hey, I don't like this version. It's not true to my vision.
Right.
So, you know, I think there's different arguments. And I do think, you know, when you're a creator, which I'm not nearly creative enough. But I think there's got to be a sense of, you know, that's my baby. I worked so hard on this. Right. And I really want to see the vision be what I envisioned. And that may not always be the best marketing choice. I mean, certainly, you know, you mentioned Captain America: Civil War. And I agree with you. I think the movie is far superior to the comic. And it diverges from the comic very, very much. I liked your description as inspired by, as opposed to an adaptation of. So, I, you know, there's definitely, it's a complex argument, really. It's more than we're going to be able to discuss in this show. But I do think there's some validity on both sides and probably will not get resolved to anybody's satisfaction in our lifetime.
I doubt it.
So going to my initial talking point was the artwork. If you look at the art on page 2, I do see where the art kind of goes to what I thought it would be. And there's like a Carmine Infantino feel about it. And I see over the course of reading this book, I was really kind of paying attention to it. And I saw influences by various artists. And it's either influences or similarities. I don't necessarily want to pigeonhole it. Mm-hmm. But I saw panels like on that particular page, the very first panel looks to me very similar to John Byrne's work. I saw stuff in the book where it looks more like a Gene Colan kind of thing. But overall, when I looked at this whole book, you know, and I said, if I had to say one artist that inspired or is similar to the work, it reminded me mostly of Steve Ditko.
Interesting. There were a couple of panels where I kind of felt the same way. I was like, that seems almost Ditko-esque in its construction.
Not only even to construction so much as even the final execution of some of the shots. I'm trying to look for the page. What page is it? Page 10, when she takes out the guy on the microphone.
The action scene, the fight, yeah.
That looks very, very Ditko-like to me. If you told me this was done in 1965 and Ditko did it, I would believe you.
Yep.
The shadowing on it, too. You know, all very much his style. I don't know that he was influenced by it or not. I couldn't tell you.
I have a particular, I'll say I give Steve Lealoha a little bit more leeway just because I have more of an emotional connection, not a personal connection, but an emotional thing. Because if anybody is familiar with the G.I. Joe comics, the most famous issue of G.I. Joe is issue 21 called The Silent Issue. That Larry Hama plotted, and Larry Hama did the breakdowns of it. It's a whole thing with Snake Eyes. It's the first appearance of Storm Shadow. They had this whole fight in the castle. But Steve Lealoha was the finisher on the book. He took the breakdowns and Larry Hama's layout and kind of finished the art on that. And Larry Hama knew him very well just from the Marvel bullpen, and there was a G.I. Joe character who was named after him, like the Torpedo, the original scuba diver from Navy SEAL guy from 1983. His file name was Edward Lealoha. And I just, because I like that, I always kind of, every time I see Steve Lealoa's name on the screen, I was like, oh, cool, that guy. Because I just have the fondness for the G.I. Joe connection. So I'll read it and I'll be like, the art is serviceable, but I might bump it up a little bit more in my esteem just because of that connection. So
I actually liked the art in this more than I expected to be honest. I'm looking it over now too. There's a shot on page 12 with Viper shooting her gun, bottom left panel.
Yep, I see. I'm looking at it.
That is to me. It's almost like he went over to Steve Ditko and said, "Could you draw this for me?"
Yeah.
It really reminds me of him a lot. Yeah. And I liked going back to the story a little bit, I liked the connection between Viper and Spider-Woman, which reminded me a lot, and maybe this is a Chris Claremont thing, of the connection that he made between Mystique and Nightcrawler. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a little vague. How did this happen? But, what's going on here? This is, what is this, 1982? So I was still actively collecting at this point. I often go into the fact that I had stopped around the time I graduated from college, which was 84, because I'm old. and then I didn't start actively collecting again until the death of Superman pulled me back in.
Uh-huh.
So about close to a 10-year period that I was not collecting. And a lot of what came out in that period I had to kind of catch up on, and a lot of it I'm still blank on. But this was before all of that, so I should have a greater knowledge of all the things that are going on with the Darkhold and all of that, but I don't. I do have a little bit of a blind spot. And I find it all very interesting because it is a storyline that shows kind of the maturation of some of the stories. When we went to the Bronze Age, you know, they started, okay, we could be a little bit more edgy with the monsters and all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I love that stuff. That's really my sweet spot when we got into those 1970s books. But by the time we got to the 80s, there was an effort, okay, we're going to still do this stuff, but we're going to try and be a little bit more literate about it, for lack of a better word, and create like a more of a connection between these things. And I do really enjoy that. And that's what makes me want to read a little bit more of this. Not so much that I'm enamored with Spider-Woman in particular. If this storyline, because I know this storyline or these characters kind of jumped from book to book a little bit, I would be more interested in following the storyline than the characters.
Once upon a time, and I mean like 10 years ago, if not more, I considered doing either a blog or a podcast, basically doing an index of the Darkhold and its appearances in books, because I love Werewolf by Night, and that's I think that's where it originated, like a lot of those other things. Because you're right, it did start kind of as like this Deus Ex Machina MacGuffin artifact in a lot of the horror books, but then it started popping up in more of the mainstream superhero things, and it kind of came this bridge for this. When I saw the Darkhold, or whenever the Darkhold is referenced in this, I was like, oh yeah, I think back to that time. And I almost did that, and then I was like, that'd be a bit too unwieldy. I don't really have the bandwidth for that.
I think we, as podcasters, I think we try to find stuff that we enjoy that's gonna, I often say I love the fact that people listen to this. I love the fact that people like it. But I do this for my own pleasure. You know, I do it because it gives me companionship with friends that I don't get to see that often. It gives me an excuse to get together on with friends and make friends that I hadn't made before and all of that stuff. But I still do have an aspect of, well, I don't want to do it if it's not going to get listened to.
Right.
And while I find this particular element of the story to be fascinating, I'm not sure a Darkhold index show would pull in much of an audience.
I'm sure that was a factor in why I decided not to do it too.
But if you should decide to do it, I will listen because I am interested in it now. So just
I appreciate you saying that, even if it's not.
If you have one if having one listener is enough to get you on board, then go
it's ahead. Not. It's not the thing.
I like I said, I feel like this opened up elements to me of things to follow up on, and by the way, I always add an unnecessary Y in the name and I say Cython. I have no idea why I do that, but I do. I don't think that's the right pronunciation, but Y is, Jessica drew a target of his or its. And then, you know, again, why, you know, what's the relationship between that demon and Viper? How did that develop? And then again, is she in fact Jessica Drew's mother? You know, and where does all of this go? I mean, there's definitely stuff that I would want to see more of.
And when I pitched this one, however many years ago, I think I had done that research and looked into that, like Viper's whole chronology and like looking into her history. And now I don't remember. Like, I don't actually remember how this, I'm almost positive this gets retconned because Jessica's origin is retold and changed a couple of different times. So
well, Bendis took over the character and changed.
Right. Right. But I don't think this connection to Viper ever comes back or it's ever realized in any way other than this.
And Viper's a character. I mean, Viper has been around, you know, there was the male version of Viper.
Right. Right.
And she was Madame Hydra at the time. And then she ended up killing him and taking on the identity of Viper. Mm-hmm. And that was all, if I remember right, that was all in Captain America, which I was a devotee of at the time. Yeah. Yeah. But the character was much more one note than it became. And it's, again, it's, you know, it's interesting sometimes to see the development of the character. But the problem is sometimes, you know, when 40 years goes by, you know, the things become a little convoluted and hard to follow, and then they retcon it out and you're like, well, you know, why I guess I just wasted my time reading all of that.
You know? And again, like Claremont is soon to leave this book, and then Mary Jo Duffy writes the last five issues, maybe four or five issues, and then it's canceled. And then the next time Jessica appears is in the Avengers when she ends up being depowered and loses all that stuff again. Tying back to the Morgan Le Fay appearance briefly in this issue. And then, yeah, I don't think they don't. I mean, she comes back regularly, but just as like a civilian PI type of character. So, because by this point, well, yeah, this is the early 80s. They're about to replace her with a new Spider-Woman coming out of Secret Wars.
Right. And then that ends up being in Force Works and... Yeah, we had a while there before.
I will mention
Bendis really powered her up again.
Both of those Spider-Womans, both Jessica Drew with her red and yellow costume and Julia Carpenter with the black and white, very Venom type of costume. Some of my favorite costume designs for any female superhero in comics. And they're both very different. They couldn't be close. They couldn't be more alike. But I love those costumes. I think they're some of the best looking female costume designs in superhero comics.
I agree. I think the costume really popped once they eliminated the full head cowl and let her hair come out, because I think that makes a big difference in just the general way of, you know, general appearance.
Totally agree. Yep.
Although the full head cowl seems better for, you know, going on a you know, undercover, not undercover, but, you know, a mission where you're in the shadows.
Right. Yeah.
You know, this seems a little too, you know, I'm going out to the disco after I fight the villains.
They also, early on, she was sort of doing a Black Canary thing where the loose flowing black hair was a wig. So it's kind of like, all right, why that? Like if you're meant to be like, if you're going to add the hair element, why isn't it just natural hair? Like you modify the costume so that you don't have to cut your hair off. But if you've like, it's already a wig, like, it looks better.
If in her civilian identity she had, say, short blonde hair and then put on this wig with the long flowing black hair, it would help to maintain the secret identity because she looks so different and people would, you know, wouldn't look at somebody with short blonde hair and think, hey, isn't that Spider-Woman? But I often make fun of, and I think I recently did it, we did a covered an issue of the Justice League, there's a scene where, you know, she puts on the wig to go out and fight. And it's like, I don't think it's that simple, because they just show her like taking the blonde wig and just putting on over her black hair without anything. I said, I'm pretty sure you'd have to like put your hair in a net and get it more close to the head, you know, and otherwise, you know, fight somebody, that blonde wig's just coming flying off anyway. In fact, I think it would probably come flying off under any circumstances, unless it's in like in this situation where she's got the mask. If the hair was actually attached to the mask, it might maintain some stability. But I think, you know, once again, as is the want of this show, we digress. I'm like, I f- one of the things I found interesting in this, and I was wondering if they have a built on it, is when she's being kind of transformed into a demon and she fights it and gets out of it. But like, is there a significance to that? Does that have an impact on her in the long run? And is that really what Satan is, you know, his ultimate goal in this thing? It confused me a little bit, but it confused me in a good way where I'm like, okay, you know, where is this going?
It's my recollection. No, that never, that has no significance beyond this issue. They don't ever come back to that.
And that's a, you know, I don't know. It just seems to me like something that could be, you know, a seed that could be built upon, but you know, what do I know?
I have to give a shout out earlier in the issue when Jessica is on the motorcycle driving down to Viper's hideout. My wife, who also rides a motorcycle, she would appreciate that they actually took the time to drive her to draw her with a helmet and goggles or glasses. So my wife is a big fan of eye protection in motorcycles. She hates I don't care if Captain America is a super soldier. If he gets a fly falls into his eye when he's going at top speed, he's gonna dump that bike.
And she's very accurate on that. Yeah. Is your wife actually related to Jessica Drew?
No, but I married her because I thought she was related to Jessica Drew.
Yeah, when I saw the name, I was like, "Wait, did he pick this issue because of that?"
Yeah, no, happy coincidence.
Any other points on this, or should we get on to rating it?
Just the last one that you pointed out, the scene, the sort of Ditko-esque, the action scene when she's fighting the Hydra goons, and it's funny that in her earliest appearance she was part of Hydra. But I love the pop of colors. I love just the classical way that the superhero's costume in this red and yellow clashes with the green of the villains. It's an attractive looking page, just for one thing, for not just for the action and the drawing, but the colors, I think, really complement each other by contrasting that way.
Yeah, as a reader, I find the contrast of the costumes to be compelling. Mm-hmm. If I sit here and I say, well, how realistic is this? Again, the colors that pop just kind of make you an easier target as far as I'm concerned. But you know, just the same, it's cool as a reader, and I think there's an element where you just have to say, I'm just, you know, it's a comic book,
right?
It's a comic book, Paul. Shut up. So, how do you rate this? You know the rating system, right?
Yeah. You want to start with the story, the cover, or the art?
Why don't you give yours? It's cover, story, art, and then overall. And what I always point out overall is the sum of the parts doesn't necessarily have to be equal to each thing. You know, it could be greater or lesser than what the individual grades are, if that's what your experience was.
The cover, I'll give a C, because I think part of it, and I was just talking about how the colors, but I think the colors kind of, the hand of K'thon is kind of being lost in the color of the background and the flames. I think it's a little bit confusing what's going on. I also don't know why her leg is changing without the context of the story. Like, I think the cover would have been fine if it's just a giant hand pulling her into some pit. But the fact that her leg seems to be changing into this like weird misshapen animal or demon leg, it's like, why is that happening? I don't think the look on her face is all that great. So I'd give the art on the cover a C. For the story, you mentioned, I mean, there's a lot going on and it's tying into a lot of previous stories. So like it could be confusing if you haven't been following along, but there's a lot going on. It's compelling. It does have a good sense of momentum with it keeps kind of changing. She's going to meeting different characters and upping the stakes and then the action and then this reversal and the dramatic hook of is this arch enemy who she's been hunting to kill, is this actually her mother, sort of Luke and Darth Vader type of thing. I'd give the story an A-, and the art inside, I'll give a B. So my overall rating would be in the B-minus range. Enjoyable, didn't knock it out of the park, but certainly nothing objectionable or mediocre about it. I think it's better than mediocre, but it's not outstanding.
Yeah, I'm not too far off from you, but I think I may have enjoyed it just a slight bit more. And I think some of that may be due to the fact that I didn't expect to.
Okay.
Just, you know, when you keep your expectations low, sometimes you're happily surprised. I kind of agree with your critique of the cover. I think the hand is a little bit lost in the coloring and the background. And I think the hoof, it almost looks like there's a turkey leg on her.
yeah, it does.
You know, and the swirling mists on the one side, I think those are designed to make the color pop, but because they're only on one side, I don't think they serve their purpose. So I'm going to say it's better than just plain average, but not a lot. So I'm going to say C+ on the cover. The interior art, maybe this is the one where I was most surprised and can feel the most connection to it. I thought it was pretty solid. I thought the storytelling was really good. I didn't get that Carmine Infantino feel that I was afraid I was going to get. And getting a Ditko feel is always a plus for me. So for the most part, I think it's pretty solid. And I'm going to say a solid B+ on the art. I really liked it. The story, I think, is exceptionally convoluted. And I think that Claremont does a good job with his exposition and his boxes mm-hmm. and all of explaining what's going on and making me feel like I wasn't lost as I read it. And it took me a little longer to read it because of that, because I had to kind of pour on each thing and kind of see, okay, where are we now? What are we doing now? But I don't really have a problem with that. In fact, if anything, I have a problem with the books that you can pick up and you read them in, 3 minutes and you're done.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed the story very much. I'm going to say a B+ on the story. I thought it was really good.
Okay.
And overall, I'm going to give the book, it's not exceptional to, I got to give this an A, but it was exceptional because I really enjoyed myself. So I'm going to say a B+ on the book.
Cool. So we're close. Yeah.
So as we mentioned earlier, I decided to go a similar route once I saw this book, and I decided to. What I did was I went on the Marvel Wiki and I put in Steve Leohola, and Leohola, and I. So what other books did he do? And I picked out Doctor Strange number 67, and I have this. I have this whole series, from beginning to end. I've recently filled that out. Yeah, once again, I picked Doctor Strange number 67 because it has the same artist. The writer is Roger Stern, so we do change there. Color is by Bob Sharon, lettered by Rick Parker, and edited by Carl Potts. It came out in, what's the date on this? It was released on July 3rd of 1984, and the cover date is October of 1984. And the story is called Private Eyes. Dr. Strange watches Jessica Drew through the Orb of Agamotto to check on her after having recently saved her life. She works with Shroud to nab a couple of criminals as Dr. Strange watches with satisfaction at her rapid recovery despite her recent ordeal. Afterwards, Dr. Strange is given a telegram by Sarah Wolf and is alarmed by its contents. He quickly goes to check on the Darkhold and is satisfied when he finds it safely secured. Meanwhile, in the dark dimension, a man named Ral casts a spell to ensnare Asti, the All-Seeing, as it passes by. He tells Asti that once his bonds fade, to inform Umar that the rebellion cannot be stopped. Ral opens a portal, quickly moves past a herd of menacing mindless ones, and encounters a crimson dome, which he enters and speaks to Clea about the success of their plan. In an office in Boston, Massachusetts, Hannibal King enjoys the afternoon sun through his window until the sudden and surreptitious appearance of Doctor Strange. They reminisce about Doctor Strange having saved him from the life of a vampire and subsequent destruction of the earthly vampire race before moving on to the current case that's vexing him. He speaks of the discovery of two men by the Boston PD in a deconsecrated church whose minds were completely blank and subsequent discovery of an alarmingly large hole by his partner Blade and Frank Drake, as well as discoveries of baffling museum thefts and animal mutilations. Strange leaves the office to speak to the mindless victims who are at a nearby hospital. At the hospital, he scans their minds with the Eye of Agamotto and discovers their minds to be completely devoid of all thought and memory, before he is gassed by a hidden man who absconds with the two mindless men. At the deconsecrated, boy, I have a trouble, tough time with that word. At the deconsecrated church where the men were first found, the Darkholders are attempting to perform a ritual using the men, which will bring forth vampires from other dimensions into theirs. Doctor Strange and Hannibal King suddenly arrive, hoping to stop the ritual from continuing, but are surprised at the Darkholders' resistance to magical and conventional attacks. The leader suggests that it is too late to stop them, as only the blood sacrifice remains, but the two mindless figures are suddenly revealed to actually be Blade and Frank Drake, and their sacrifice would be meaningless for the ritual. The leader instead sacrifices himself, and a vampiric creature emerges through the portal, but quickly disintegrates. Later, at a Boston night spot, Blade is musing about what happened and why the vampire fell apart, and Doctor Strange reveals that the ritual was futile because his previous spell had removed the curse which allowed vampires to exist in their dimension and could only be counteracted if the curse was restored. This was another one. This was similar in many ways to the previous issue that I had to really focus on what was going on to get the feel for it. I do have knowledge of the fact that at one point Doctor Strange had been involved in the elimination of all vampires in the Marvel mm-hmm. universe, including mm-hmm. Dracula. Yep. And to think that there would be ritualistic people who are trying to bring them back for the power that they'd bring them is really a natural step from that. And I thought it was very good to be explored in this story. So, you know, I did enjoy reading this, and this is another one again, and it's, you know, it joins the very, very large list of issues that make me want to read more of it.
Mm-hmm.
So whether or not that will ever happen, I would say probably won't, because there's so many things that I want to read. I don't know that I will live long enough to read all of it, but mm-hmm. I really enjoy this, and I've always kind of liked Roger Stern's writing as well. Different from Claremont, but equally entrenched in Marvel lore or in lore of whatever series he's writing.
And I would say high floor again. Like, you're not going to get a bad Roger Stern comic.
Yeah. And I thought the story and the art kind of played well together. So, you know, overall it was well done. Now, was this one you had read before, or?
I hadn't. I'd read like earlier issues from this Doctor Strange run, and I read some of the Doctor Strange volume that came after this that Roy Thomas started in the late 80s or early 90s, I don't remember. But I hadn't read this late into the Doctor Strange run, so this was a new read for me, and I really enjoyed it. I did, for one thing, I liked all the cameos, seeing Jessica Drew again, and I noted, like, in the history, this is her first appearance after the two-part Avengers story where she is depowered. So to see like this kind of like following up after that storyline that Roger Stern kind of authored to in the Avengers issues, and getting the Shroud cameo working with her, because the Shroud started in earlier issues of Spider-Woman 2, and then seeing the guys who will eventually become the Night Stalkers, which is Blade, Hannibal King, and Frank Drake, because I knew about them from the 90s when I was reading more of the 90s horror books like Ghost Rider and the Midnight Suns, that whole story arc. So I knew these characters from that. And I love Tomb of Dracula. So all of the stuff that came out of that. So I enjoyed all of the other characters besides Doctor Strange popping up into this one, but I also really liked him. And the story surprised me twice, like in terms of the plot. There were two elements where I was like, I didn't see that coming, or I thought that was a mistake and it turned out to be not a mistake. And because of that, I was like genuinely impressed a few times. So I like this one a lot.
Yeah. I also, some of the plot twists mm-hmm. I didn't see coming as well. So mm-hmm. I like that. I would say that, you know, again, focusing on the art, this did seem to me almost to be more consciously going for a Steve Ditko kind of look.
I had that note too. Yeah.
But I like Steve Lealoha in the previous issue where he inked himself more than him being inked here by who actually, who was the actually, I don't. Yeah, the, no, wait, I'm looking at the wrong link. Give me a second. Where the heck did I do with it?
This one says he used the art, so I think he.
I thought somebody else. No, he inked himself here also. So, for whatever reason, I feel like this feels like the inking is more rushed, or more of an effort to marry the Steve Ditko look with kind of a Gene Colan look.
Yeah.
As far as the shading goes. And I don't know, while I felt like he successfully channeled Ditko in the other book, I feel like adding that Colan-esque feel to it actually diminishes it. And I love Gene Colan's work, so don't get me wrong.
He's my favorite artist.
But I don't know that it's successfully married in this particular issue. Some of the facial expressions don't look quite right to me, particularly on Doctor Strange.
Mm-hmm.
So once we go to the other dimension and we have this Rebel and his thing, that's where it really starts to get a Ditko feel for me.
Yeah. I see it. I see those connections too. I noticed right away. I was like, I think he's deliberately trying to channel a little bit of Ditko, because obviously Ditko is the creator of Doctor Strange. And I think you're mentioning the Gene Colan thing too, because Colan worked on Doctor Strange for so long too. So I see both of those elements, but you're right. Like, he's trying to weave them together, but it's not better or as good as either Ditko or Colan. But
even a standalone, not comparing them to two of the all-time great artists.
Right.
I think the previous issue felt less, like the art felt less conflicted. It's almost like he's trying to marry two styles here that don't mesh together. They're both great, yeah. But when you put them together, they actually diminish themselves. Because one of Steve Ditko's strengths, if you go to like early issues of Spider-Man, one of his real strengths is the shadow work.
And
as far as Colan's work, he also has a very distinct shadowy feel to the way he does things, but they aren't the same.
No.
So when you take Ditko's figure work or facial work and then try and add a Colan-esque shadow to it, it doesn't feel right to me.
Right. No, I agree with that.
And I don't even know that this was his. Well, I think we can pretty much say yes, he was trying to get a Ditko look, and I think you're right, because Ditko was he was the creator of Doctor Strange, so I don't have a doubt that he would try and use a little bit of that stylistic feel for it. But I don't know for a fact that he was trying to give it Colan-like shadowing, but that's what it feels like to me again. Mm-hmm. So I maybe I'm wrong. It's interesting to see the way Blade was drawn at this point. Had Wesley Snipes portrayed him yet?
No.
1994? No, he didn't. It was the early 2000s. It was like 10 years later that he did it. Because it is very different.
The Blade was 98.
Okay, so it's still 4 years beforehand.
Yeah. This Blade is very much from the is very much out of a Tomb of Dracula look.
Yes. But very, very different from, once the Wesley Snipes version influenced artists.
Right. At some point in the mid-90s, Blade had his own, was it a series or mini-series? But he kind of
got a
new look where he had a black leather jacket over a red shirt. And they did kind of like sort of modernize him a little bit more, where his look in this one is a lot closer to his 70s aesthetic.
And again, this whole storyline of trying to revive the vampires, and not reviving them because I was a lackey of Dracula and I want to, I'm loyal to him and I'm trying to bring him back. Not at all. This is, I can revive them and I will usurp the power that he had, and I will basically become the king of the vampires.
Right. Classic. Yeah. So Steven Spell basically eliminated all vampires on Earth. We're like, well, we're going to bring vampires from different dimensions, different realities. It's like, that actually seems like a clever workaround. I can kind of buy the logic behind that. And then the fact that as soon as the vampires show up in this dimension, they instantly just vaporize. It's like, nope, spell still works. It's not just the spell. was about kind of like maintaining the security of the Earth, not just eliminating those specific vampires. So, but yeah, like there was the other, like when the lackey throws the smoke bomb and basically knocks everybody out in the hospital, I'm like, okay, these heroes like Blade and Dr. Strange, I was like, they got knocked out way too early. That was like way too convenient for these guys to like kidnap the bodies and take them to their hideout. And I was like, well, it turns out, no, that was a feint to get them to lead them. That was a, also that they could follow these guys back to their hidden base. And when it's, you know, Strange and Hannibal King are chasing them, I'm like, why did we even have Blade and Frank Drake in this issue? Like, they didn't amount to anything. Like, that part was kind of ridiculous. And then it turns out, no, they were the ones impersonating, like, the bodies that they had taken. So, like, that was the second time where I was like, oh, I thought that was kind of a mistake or just a missed opportunity on Roger Stern's part. But he actually, nope, he used that. He fooled me the same way the heroes fooled the villain. And I was like, that is really good. That is clever.
Now, the acolytes here that are trying to get the power, are they vampires who were turned to human state by Doctor Strange's machinations?
Does it mention?
I'm not sure if it says it or not, but if they were, then that could even explain the, you know, put in air quotes, selfless sacrifice of the one acolyte killing himself to revive the vampires, because his thought process might be, once we bring vampires back into this dimension, I'm a vampire and I will be revived.
Right.
So I'm not really sacrificing my life. I'm just taking on the pain of slitting my own throat or stabbing myself, whatever it is that he does. So that's, you know, I'm not sure if that's me reading into it or if that's just the reality.
I'm not sure if it addresses that. Yeah, I don't know.
That's the impression I had, and that's what I'm going to I'm going to mind canon that. Because I think it makes more sense for these, because they're showing themselves again. It's not, oh, I'm so loyal to Dracula, I want to bring back him. It's right. He's gone and I want the power.
Exactly.
So if you're doing this to get the power, why would you sacrifice yourself? Except if you think, well, by doing this, I'm going to be revived again anyway. So I kind of like that aspect of it. I do find it funny, and I don't see it that often. I mean, you saw it with the Defenders, so I guess it's there. But Doctor Strange always strikes me, at least in this solo series, as more of a loner. So I find it kind of amusing to see him sitting at a table sharing a couple of beers with these guys.
Yeah.
It seemed like his only companions were Wong and Clea.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, other than, you know, oh, I need the Hulk and Submariner to come and help me do something.
Yeah, it's like they ask, he's like, hey, we're going to go for a celebratory drink. You want to join us? He's like, Namor never asks me that.
And, you know, I'm just going to give my, again, non sequitur, but we recently got back from a trip to California, my wife and I, and one of the things we did was we drove by La Jolla, where there's sea lions and seals and things like that. And you come over, it's my first time ever in California. You come over to like the side of the road and you're looking down at the beach, which is, you know, probably 150 feet down or whatever it is. And they're all over the beach. And my wife wanted to get closer. And just the smell of these things was, it was almost overwhelming. I was like, I'm not getting any closer than we are now. This is already starting to bother me. And I just think like maybe going out for a beer with the Submariner might be like that. So that's kind of all my notes on this. So I don't know if you have anything else.
On what page 17, the lower left corner of like they're raising up this kind of onyx black stone totem thing. It's vague. You can't really see what it is, but I like the idea of it. It feels sort of Lovecraftian, and this is supposed to be something like before time, some image of some elder god or something that you would just go crazy if you looked at this too long. It doesn't really give you a full image, but I just think, I was like, oh, that's kind of cool looking. That just evokes something more scary and mystical.
I like your interpretation on that better than mine, because when I looked at it, I was connecting it to the prior issue, and I was looking at it as being similar to a Hydra symbol.
Oh, yeah. Good, yeah. I'm trying to think. I like not just like the action, but the way Steven looks when he's using his powers. And again, going for a little bit of the Ditko aspect of it, but just, yeah, very, very simple, but clean looking when he's, you know, you know, casting his almost Spider-Man hands, the flip hand, in order to like blast them.
Yeah. The choreography of the fight scenes, I think, is very good. Like I said, my biggest criticism is some of the shadowing and some of the facial aspects.
Yeah. Yeah.
But overall, you know, good read and made me want to read more. So that's always a plus. Yeah. So I guess we can rate this. I'm going to say, I got to go back to the cover. It's taking me way too long here. There we go. This almost seems typical of Doctor Strange issues of the mid-80s to into the 2000s, where you don't really get that much of a feel from the story from the cover, even though this is indicative kind of what's going on. But looking at it, you're not going to say, "Oh, look, he's got Blade and Hannibal King," and you know, it's an action scene with Doctor Strange in it. And you know there's something mystic going on by the tentacles that are coming out to get him. The white background is very common in these covers as well, which I like a little bit more background. But the colors do pop a little bit because of the white, so I'll kind of negate my dislike of no backgrounds. Overall, I'd say it's pretty solid. It's pretty interesting. If you're interested in the Doctor Strange character, it's compelling. I'm going to say a C+ on the cover. The interior art, I think, is a step down from the previous issue for the reasons we talked about. So I'm going to put a C+ on the art also. It's still above average, and there's still a lot to be said for it. The story is the strength of this issue. I think the story is a solid B+. And overall, I'm going to give the book a B.
Okay. I think I liked it just a little bit more than you. I think I liked this one a little bit more than my pick, the Spider-Woman pick. For the cover, I agree. I really dislike white backgrounds on covers. I can't give something an A if it's just got an all-white background. I kind of think any color, like even if there's no background illustration, but just if the cover is all black or all blue or all pink or something like that, it's a little bit more interesting than all white. I also can't identify that this is Blade, Hannibal King, and Frank Drake from this image. Like, I don't know who those guys are until I read the story. And it's just three kind of civilians, so it's going to be hard to draw them in a way that does make it. But you could probably at least recognize Blade. You should be able to see him the way he's like dressed. His, you know, at this time he was wearing goggles. He should have like a stake in his hand or something. And the fact that these guys are all wearing green, like, I was like, are these guys all like agents or like put like something going on, like working together? And but I like the image of like the thing coming out. So I'll give the cover a B minus maybe. The art inside, I liked it a little bit more than you, but I kind of recognize some of the same problems. So I would say a B- for the interior art. A lot I liked, but just some of the stuff I was like, okay. The story, I give the story an A. I did enjoy it a lot more than I expected. I had no expectations going in, but I liked it a lot. So my full grade is going to be B+.
All right, so we're not too far apart on this thing overall. Two enjoyable books. I really, you know, I love when I can kind of expand my horizons a little bit with the books that we read, and this managed to get me to do that on both ends. So thanks for that.
I enjoyed the continuity between the two of them. There was a connection to it. That was fun.
Yeah, me too. And again, it's got me interested in reading more. If I find myself with a little extra free time at some point, I could see picking them out and trying to. I got to see online if there's a kind of a Darkhold continuity guide, which there probably is somewhere.
So somebody should do a podcast about it.
Yeah, there you go. So thanks for coming on with me and doing this, Ryan. I appreciate it. And thank you, everybody, who's listening. And like I said, seek out the Cheers cast, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.